Hello, and welcome to Spy Hard's podcast, where your hosts go deep undercover into the world of spy movies to decipher which films make the knock list. But remember, this information is strictly for your ears only. I'm Dr. Scott.
And I'm Dr. Cam. Doctor.
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 Doctor. Well, we are talking about a very beloved film this week, but before we get there, we have to induct a new Spy Hards Die Hard.
That is right. And of course, if you want to become a Spy Hards Die Hard, you leave a 5-star review for us on Apple Podcasts, and then we read it on the show and make you a Spy Hards Die Hard, and also give you a very special codename tied into the title of the movie we are tackling that very week. This week is going to be a little bit of a challenge, so I'm going to get creative, because I think the code name using this movie title would be a little unwieldy, so I have an alternate.
Oh, I came up with an alternate too. I'll be interested to see what one you've brought up.
Okay.
Well, this week's Spy Hards Die Hards comes from us, from the US Apple Podcasts, and Shaver CL, who writes, "Excellent movie podcast. Cam and Scott have a well-produced, wonderfully executed podcast. While limited to spy movies, they do an excellent job at finding a variety of types of spy movies, from comedies to westerns, and from the silent movies to the current releases. Their conversations about the movies are cogent, comprehensive, nuanced, and frequently funny. Love Scott's puns." I like this guy.
You wrote this, didn't you?
I am Shaver CL. You found me out. You found me out. We continue. "They have a great rapport and bring on intelligent and entertaining guests. I appreciate that they get to the reviews quickly and generally keep the conversation to under 2 hours. A must listen each week for me, and I can't recommend it highly enough."
Well, thank you very much. And so when it comes to the code name, it's got to be Doctor, right?
See, I was thinking Doctor or GLG20.
I think it's tougher to remember the latter one, whereas just Doctor. Or the Doctor, whatever.
The Doctor. Very Doctor Who-ish. The Doctor.
Yeah. And also, There's no spy movies on our master list called The Doctor or Doctor.
This episode's going to have a lot of the word Doctor in it, isn't it?
It is. It is, yes.
It is. Okay. Well, let's go with it then. Shaver CL, your code name is Doctor. You are the latest inductee in the Spy Hards Die Hards. Thank you for the wonderful 5-star review. And if you want to join that list, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Say whatever you want. Make it funny if you'd like. As long as it's 5-star, we'll read it out on the show. But Cam, I think without further ado, let's get to the review. Cam, it's time to grab a Pepsi. What are we talking about this week?
We are talking about 1985's Spies Like Us, starring Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd, and directed by John Landis.
This is a film that's been mentioned to us a bunch of times, and it's been a while since we've done a spy comedy, certainly one of this sort of stature in the pantheon of spy movies. This is one that gets brought up a lot, especially from the 80s. This and the other spy, the Zucker comedy.
Oh, Top Secret. Yeah.
Top Secret, that's the one. Yeah, these two get brought up a lot, so I'm glad we're finally looking at it.
Yeah, it's an interesting one in that very, 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 very badly reviewed at the time of its release, but it's one that has definitely had legs and has a real cult fandom around it. So it is interesting just how some of these movies really do gain life, especially, I would imagine, this one showing on TV a lot back in the day.
Absolutely, especially with that cast, with Chevy and Dan. That they're like, the 80s is their period. This is them at the height of their powers.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit of, say, like some of those Jim Carrey comedies, which also critics were really harsh on. Mm-hmm. If you ask anyone of a certain age group about the Ace Ventura films or Dumb and Dumber, those are like comedy classics of their time, right? So I think like Spies Like Us has a little bit of that effect.
Yeah, well, and that's a very good sort of comparison there, because for me, the Ace Ventura films were something we just played a lot in our household growing up. Dumb and Dumber too, actually, and me, myself, and Irene, just basically Jim Carrey fans.
Yeah, same in my house. And also the early Adam Sandler stuff, like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. Also, not critical darlings, those two movies.
Nope, certainly not. Happy Gilmore was one we played a lot. I think I saw more of Richard Kiel in that film than I did in the Bond films growing up.
Oh, okay. Right. Not Force 10 from Navarone.
No, not so much. Not so much.
That wasn't a big hit in the Hardy household.
It certainly wasn't, though. We were too busy doing Scotty impressions while running around pools.
Okay, fair enough.
But if you haven't ever seen Spies Like Us, here is your synopsis. And much like the plot of this film, it's very thin.
Yes.
Spies like us. With spies like these, who needs enemies?
It feels like, I don't know, like a Catskills comedian wandering on stage and dropping that one.
What's the deal with these spies?
Yeah.
Who likes them? Two bumbling government employees think they are US spies, only to discover that they are actually decoys for nuclear war.
That definitely feels like how you would have pitched this movie to a studio.
Yeah, that is the elevator pitch, isn't it? You get one floor, that's it. You're saying that. Interestingly enough, they think they're spies. They are spies.
They are technically spies, but they have no intel as to what they are doing. So, yeah, it's interesting. I don't know that we have a movie. I guess we do, actually. A movie like this, I was going to say, where it's basically a spy film involving characters who know nothing at all about what's going on.
There's one from this very decade, a couple of years later.
I know, that's the one I'm thinking of, which is a very similar movie I'm sure we'll talk about going forward. But, I mean, you can say, like, oh, that could be North by Northwest. Cary Grant doesn't know what's going on. But, like, it's someone who's actively figuring it out versus this movie, which they are not really trying to actively figure anything out.
Well, this movie is frustrating in the sense that it won't even tell you what's going on anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I did find that to be an issue, yes.
Well, which we'll get to. But how did these spies get so much like us is what I really want to know, Cam. So I'm going to bat it back to you. Tell us.
Okay, so the central reason this movie exists is Dan Aykroyd. And Dan Aykroyd, do I have to explain who he is? Probably not, but I'll give a...
No, please do.
Yeah, a tiny bit of background. Just Canadian comic actor and writer. And in the mid-70s, joined Saturday Night Live at its launch. And Saturday Night Live was a very big deal for, I think, pretty much everyone knows, launched a lot of talent in that era. You know, Bill Murray, Eddie Murphy, John Belushi, just tons of all-stars. And off of the popularity of Saturday Night Live, he started working in movies like 1941, the Spielberg film, Blues Brothers, Trading Places. And one thing people maybe don't know, though, about Dan Aykroyd is that he plays a pretty active role as a writer in a lot of his films, which I don't know that people necessarily think about when they think of Dan Aykroyd. And his writing career kicked off, obviously, on Saturday Night Live, but he also, in 76, wrote a Beach Boys TV movie called It's Okay. And then, you know, following his work on Saturday Night Live, wrote the or co-wrote the scripts for The Blues Brothers and Ghostbusters.
I do want to interject. I want to interject because I love this idea, this assertion from you that people around the world don't know that he's a writer. What an assumption on your part. I love that.
Did you know that? Did you know he co-wrote like so many of his movies?
I'm not the person that's being scrutinized right now, Cam. Let's not bring me up here. This is about you and your assumptions. Maybe everyone knows that.
I suspect if I talk to most people I know who are fans of Ghostbusters and I asked them if they knew that Dan Aykroyd co-wrote it, they would not know.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Right?
No, I had no idea, actually. No idea.
Yeah. And so he does Ghostbusters in 84. That is a mega hit. Blues Brothers, also a big hit, but Ghostbusters is next level. And this is the follow-up to Ghostbusters for him.
This is the follow-up to Ghostbusters.
Comes out the next year, yes.
Wow. That explains a few things, actually, of thoughts I'd had. Okay, but please continue.
Yeah, and I mean, going forward, he would have co-writing credits on movies like Dragnet, Ghostbusters 2, Coneheads, Blues Brothers 2000. So, yeah, very active, not just in front of the camera, but behind as well. So it was announced March 1st, 1982, in Variety, that Aykroyd would be collaborating with John Belushi on the film, and they would be co-writing it together. 4 days after that announcement, John Belushi passed away from a drug overdose.
Wow.
So that definitely had a massive effect on kind of the movie's momentum because it did kind of sit quietly for a little bit, obviously, as there was a lot of grieving. John Belushi is such a crucial part to that dynamic. I mean, the Blues Brothers was huge, and this would have been their follow-up because they didn't do a sequel to Blues Brothers together. This would have been their reteaming.
Well, just to preface it, was this announced as Spies Like Us with those two, or was it they're working on a film together?
It was basically that. They are going to be writing this script together and it's going to become a film.
Was it announced as a spy film, comedy, yada, yada, yada? Okay.
So spy film.
The bare bones was announced. Okay.
Yes. So about 2 months later, it was announced that Dave Thomas would be working with Dan Aykroyd on the film. Now, Dave Thomas, Canadian comedian and actor, he didn't work in Saturday Night Live. He came from SCTV, where he was a writer and performer from 1976 to 1981. And following that TV show, that very successful Canadian comedy show, he co-wrote and starred in the film Strange Brew with Rick Moranis, which was not like a massive hit, but was a real cult hit that continues to be popular to this day. And so for him, Spies Like Us would actually be his follow-up to Strange Brew in terms of motion pictures. He'd done TV work, but this would have been his next major, you know, big screen comedy.
And I suppose now is a time as good as any to interject that Dave Thomas, the wonderful Dave Thomas, is actually joining us later this week to talk about his work on the film and his wonderful career in comedy. So look out for that in your podcast feeds this Friday.
That's right. And Dave Thomas, for those who are maybe not familiar with SCTV, is also known. He was a regular on Grace Under Fire, the very popular 90s sitcom. He's been on Arrested Development, done voices on King of the Hill. And if you just go through his IMDb, just a long string of credits. The man has a very impressive filmography.
Mr. F.
Yes. And so Aykroyd and Dave Thomas saw this as an homage to the Bob Hope, Bing Crosby road films, like some other film that we maybe tackled from this decade in the past. Yeah. And so they basically had kicked around ideas, but Dan Aykroyd said the ideas were basically formless. So they took a road trip to Ian Fleming's house, Goldeneye, in Jamaica.
Wow.
And apparently Dan Aykroyd even sat at Ian Fleming's desk at one point. So that was kind of the key to their inspiration for this film.
So they were trying to make a true sort of Fleming-esque thriller at one point.
I am very curious, like, how this kind of came to be. Like, they want to do this, you know, tribute to the road films. They probably latched on the idea of doing like a spy comedy.
There's just a little bit of a cognitive dissonance, because I don't think Mike Myers was going to the Berlin Wall to get inspiration for Austin Powers. You know what I mean? Those things don't go together in my head.
No, but if you tell me that Mike Myers was going to Goldeneye, it actually makes sense to me. Whereas I don't watch Spies Like Us and think, oh, this is so James Bond.
No, I think it's something else. Actually, I think it's a few different things meshed together.
Yeah, yeah. But I did find that interesting that they went to Goldeneye.
Also, I will just jump in. It's Jamaica. It's lovely. Why would you not want to go there for holiday anyway?
That's true. That's true. And so they put together a draft of the screenplay, and they brought in John Landis, who was going to be directing the film. Now, John Landis had worked with Aykroyd in the past. He directed Trading Places. He also directed segments of The Twilight Zone, somewhat notoriously. But the section of The Twilight Zone that he worked on with Aykroyd was not the one that resulted in fatalities. They actually did the kind of the intro sections, which featured Dan Aykroyd, and John Landis directed those. And they'd also worked on a movie called Into the Night as well together, a thriller that I have not seen. Now, John Landis, somewhat of a problematic figure to talk about these days, just due to the tragedy of the Twilight Zone set where actor Vic Morrow and two children were killed in a helicopter accident. But he's someone who, in this era, was an incredibly popular filmmaker. And he'd gotten his start in the mailroom of 20th Century Fox and somehow kind of wound up traveling to Europe and working as an assistant director uncredited on the Clint Eastwood 1970 film Kelly's Heroes. And once that movie had wrapped, he stuck around and worked in spaghetti westerns for a while as an actor and a stuntman and various other jobs, and then came back to America and in the early 70s directed and wrote a spoof movie called Schlock, kind of a tribute to B-movies.
Sure.
And then directed a movie called Kentucky Fried Movie, again, kind of a spoof film that was sort of a compilation package, if you will. These were very popular cult comedies that put his name on the map. And then he co-wrote and directed a little movie called National Lampoon's Animal House, which was one of the big comedies of its time. And then wrote and directed The Blues Brothers, wrote and directed An American Werewolf in London, directed Trading Places, and as well as I mentioned, you know, Twilight Zone. He's someone who was like a big name in the 1980s. And following the Twilight Zone, his career would get a little more dried up. He had a couple hits, like Coming to America, for example, but then had a number of bombs like Oscar, Beverly Hills Cop 3, Blues Brothers 2000, that kind of just ended his film career in a way. And so he's mostly working in TV these days. But him and Aykroyd had a very tight relationship. And John Landis was very much in with that kind of SNL crowd, having worked with Eddie Murphy multiple times. So he was a natural person to collaborate with on this film.
And you can mention other things about the guy's career. He'd done a lot of music videos, some of the most famous ones of all time, like Black and White and Thriller for Michael Jackson.
Yep.
Like he, a prolific director. It's a name, if you have watched any media of the 90s, he's probably got his finger in somewhere.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, exactly. Like, and one of the defining sort of comedy directors of the 80s. Once he was on board and they have their draft, they decided they need to have a punch-up done on it. So they brought in two writers, Lowell Gantz and Babalu Mandel, who are pretty, I think, well-known for being associated with producer Brian Grazer, who worked on this film, but Ron Howard. And Ron Howard has hired them multiple times on his films. And they started out in sitcoms, working on shows like Laverne and Shirley, Busting Loose, Happy Days. And Happy Days being the key one, because that kind of brings them into the orbit of Ron Howard.
Sure.
And they moved into movies in the early 80s. They did a movie called The Night Shift in 82, which was directed by Ron Howard and starring Henry Winkler. And it was actually like a really fun comedy. Michael Keaton is great in it. And then they did, 2 years later, a movie called Splash. And their careers were off and running because Splash, with, of course, Tom Hanks, was a massive phenomenal hit.
It's a film we've mentioned before, I think, when we did our review of The Man with One Red Shoe all those years ago, and I've yet to watch it since.
Yeah, that would be a fun one to do on the Patreon at some point, actually.
Splash.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in forever.
Okay. Is it... actually, don't tell me. Let's do it on the Patreon. But okay.
Yeah, at some point. At some point.
The fact that it's come up twice now in 3 years means I think I probably should watch it.
Yeah. And so, you know, you think about it. This movie, Spies Like Us, is the follow-up for Dan Aykroyd from Ghostbusters,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
For these two writers, Gantz and Mandel, this is their follow-up to Splash. So this is like a team coming together who has a very strong track record, plus John Landis having done Trading Places, which was also a mega hit.
And I can't imagine Chevy Chase is unpopular at this time. This has got to be like Fletch and all that stuff's got to be out around about now.
We'll get back to that in a second, because yes, Chevy Chase is also on top of the world. And those two writers, you know, Lowell Gantz and Babalu Mandel, would go on and do movies like Parenthood, City Slickers, A League of Their Own, Multiplicity. Their last major film credit was The Tooth Fairy with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Then they've just done a couple TV things since. But I think they're getting older now. I don't know if they're working as much. But very key voices in 80s, 90s comedy.
Sure. For the generation of most people listening to this podcast, I imagine they have influenced at least a couple of the films that you've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is, when I was looking up some of the behind the scenes, is that there's a lot of like questions I have about what the actual vision of this movie was over time, because at a certain point, it's indicated that this was seen as a starring vehicle, perhaps for Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis, reteaming them from Strange Brew.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how long that was under consideration versus just having Aykroyd star opposite someone else. I'm wondering if with the passing of John Belushi, if they initially were like, okay, well, if we can't have them as a duo as the lead, maybe we consider Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis, perhaps?
Well, that sounds like a question we could definitely take to Dave later this week.
Exactly. I would like to know that one for sure. At a certain point, though, Chevy Chase became available because he abandoned another spy film that was in the making. It never happened, and he wasn't happy with what that project was. And so he was brought onto this movie. And according to an interview with Chevy Chase, at the time, this movie was being rewritten as a vehicle for Dan Aykroyd and Richard Pryor. So Richard Pryor at one point was being seen as the co-lead, and Chevy Chase then was available and was hired.
I could see it either way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Richard Pryor, again, was like also at the height of his powers. Another prolific comedian of the 80s. I'm not saying that he's interchangeable with Chevy Chase and they have their own strengths and weaknesses, but they're writing towards it being Richard Pryor. They were right towards him.
I think the main takeaway is they were looking to write this for some of the top comedians around.
Sure.
Like, they knew they wanted two top-tier comic actors pairing up, and they were kind of playing around with what the actual duo would be.
Yeah, which I think is a like any pre-production process of a film. Makes sense.
Yeah. And Dan Aykroyd has said Chevy Chase was actually the key to getting the movie made. He said like he had a lot of ideas. They were all interested in doing it, but the hiring of Chevy Chase was basically what opened up the door. There was also notably like a Variety note that Carl Gottlieb was going to be associated with writing this film in some capacity. Carl Gottlieb famously wrote Jaws, or was one of the writers on Jaws. Right. He was the one on set. But there's nothing in the credits, no sign of this whatsoever, but there was an announcement at one point that he would be associated. Not sure what happened there.
Okay. There's already a few hands in the pot for this one, so maybe just at one point they thought they needed some advice and it never happened, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And then Donna Dixon, the female lead of the film, was reluctant to audition for the film because she was married to Dan Aykroyd. They had gotten together in 1983, and apparently she turned down Ghostbusters because Dan Aykroyd wanted her in there as well. And she'd said no, but she agreed to do this one. They did work together a couple times, but this being one of their films. Donna Dixon, I think, probably best known to a later generation as the woman in the Foxy Lady song number in Wayne's World.
Oh. Is that her?
It is, yeah.
I didn't put that together. I mean, I've got some notes about her in this film, which we'll get to, but yeah, I did not put that together. I had never really, well, I thought I had never encountered her before until this film.
Yeah, and her and Aykroyd were married around 83 and separated just last year or the year before, 2022, but are still legally married. So they definitely had a long run and three kids, I think.
To be fair, so are we.
Yeah, no kidding, no kidding. So the budget for this movie was $22 million, which was seen as quite high at that point. Like, it went over budget.
Sure.
But domestically, it did $60.1 million. And I don't have international numbers. I don't know if in this era they were particularly aggressive about putting American comedies into international territories. That was commonly not the case because I couldn't even find an international number that was backed up by anything. There was a link to one on Wikipedia that just led back to a Box Office Mojo page that indicated nothing about international numbers.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I mean, I mentioned this on Twitter recently, or X, or whatever you'd like to call it. And a lot of European people and British people commented on seeing it, and some at the theaters. So I imagine it did get some play here.
It must have gotten some sort of release, but they didn't put a lot of muscle behind international releases for comedies, especially in the 1980s.
But you said it before. This feels exactly like something that got played a lot at home.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's just take that domestic number of $60.1 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we have. We don't have international numbers.
Sure.
So that means its worldwide total, the best that I can put together, is $60.1 million.
Mm-hmm.
That made it the number 10 highest grossing film at the worldwide box office for the year. All it needed was domestic money to be number 10. That's how successful this movie was.
That's insane.
Yeah.
I actually did I did some math on inflation in films recently, and I kind of know what the average change would be. So I could give you a rough estimate of what it made if it had come out now, more or less. Would you like to hear it?
I would, sure, yeah.
So I've crunched the numbers.
Okay.
And this is very rough, so I'll round it up a little bit. But if this had come out now, it would have made around about $190 million.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty darn good for a comedy nowadays. I mean, most filmmakers would kill for a number like that if you sit and examine box office numbers from this past year.
And also, a $22 million budget would go up to about $80 million. So they're still doubling their budget and then some, which is the barometer for success. So sounds like it did well.
Yeah. And as I said, number 10 for the year between The Goonies and Police Academy 2, Their First Assignment, another 80s comedy. This is the era of high-concept 80s comedies. And when we look at some of the other movies that ranked lower, you have Chevy Chase, number 12, Fletch.
Oh.
And also, at number 14, National Lampoon's European Vacation. This may have been Chevy Chase's biggest year.
Wow, that's... Yeah, he's headlining three films that all did okay.
Did very well, yeah.
So when I think of under 10, I think that it's lesser. But you're right, they're in the top 20.
Yeah, worldwide box office.
Worldwide. I mean, as a millennial, I hate to throw that term around, my exposure to Chevy Chase was more in television later on with shows like Community. mm-hmm. and just going back through time and watching from films from time to time. But there was a time, for people who were about my age, where Chevy Chase was the man.
Yeah, and I kind of missed it too. I saw a couple movies like Three Amigos when I was younger.
Good film.
And some of the National Lampoon's Vacation films. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't like an icon in my house. We were more of like a John Candy, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray kind of house of their 80s, 90s stuff. Mm-hmm. So the top three for the year, number one was Out of Africa. Number two was Back to the Future. And number three, Rambo, First Blood Part 2.
You love saying that one, don't you?
I do. That's always a fun one to say. Of course, co-written by James Cameron.
That's not what I think about when I think about that film. But I will just say, it's funny that Out of Africa is one and Back to the Future is two. I would say in terms of legacy, you'd swap those around.
Out of Africa, not one of the best Best Picture winners out there.
No. Although I don't think Back to the Future would have won Best Picture either.
Probably should have.
Well.
Probably should have.
Definitely not this film either.
Yes. And so just a couple of final notes. John Landis directed the Paul McCartney title song video for the film, which featured Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd, although not actually performing. The song peaked at number 7 on the US charts and number 13 in the UK.
This is the last time I think McCartney charted in the top 10
mm-hmm.
in America, until now at least. In terms of a single, albums might be different.
Yeah.
But in a single sense.
Yeah.
He also never released this on an album until he released a bunch of like singles as an album, like I think either in the noughties or the 90s. So he's just sort of sit on this one for a while. You had to buy the single.
Why do you think that was?
I don't think he's particularly proud of it. I've seen him live numerous times and I've never really heard a Spides Like Us chant coming out from the crowd. I mean, if you read some of the lyrics, if you've never heard the song, which it wouldn't surprise me because it's not something that gets played on the radio, it's a very poor song. It's not got a hook to it. And just taking an aside for a minute about Paul McCartney, because I'm a big Beatles fan, if you'll indulge me, Cameron.
Sure.
The 1980s, and when it comes to pop music videos, is a big time. They even mention MTV in this film. MTV satellites get blown up and you see MTV on the screen. Free publicity there for MTV. Or they paid for it. But pop music videos were very important. And one important piece of 80s music video is Paul Simon's You Can Call Me Al, which of course stars Chevy Chase.
Mm-hmm.
That is what it's remembered for. It is not remembered for his appearance in the Spies Like Us music video. And I can tell you for why. He isn't in it, apart from about 5 seconds. It's a real waste of time. Because they do actually shoot that music video at Abbey Road Studios here in London. They do a little like walk out the front, you know, the Beatles walk for the Abbey Road album out the front. They reference that in the music video. There's a lot of gags, but it feels so low effort compared to what you got from You Can Call Me Al. Now, I don't know the release date of You Can Call Me Al. I could probably Google it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to. But I think either they learned lessons from this and improved on it, or he just wasn't invested in this music video, because it is a real letdown for Paul McCartney fans, and so is this song, frankly.
Which song do you prefer? This song or the Gotcha song?
The Gotcha song's got a hook.
Yeah.
I can sing it to you now. Gotcha, gotcha, where I want you. It's too late to stop right now. I remembered that from 2 years ago. I haven't listened to the song since. I just listened to the Spies Like Us song before we started recording, and I can't remember it.
Isn't that crazy that Paul McCartney, of all people, is the one being inferior in this arena to the Gotcha theme song?
It is crazy. And I went one step further, you'll be pleased to know. I wrote down what I think are the top 5 Paul McCartney movie tie-in songs. Would you like to hear them?
Okay, Live and Let Die is an obvious one, but what else you got?
Live and Let Die is number one for me. I think, it, you know, Spy Movie Podcast, I love that film, and I love that soundtrack, and I love that song. So that wins number one.
Yeah.
Number two, I gave it to A Hard Day's Night.
Sure.
I don't think you can really beat that. Good film, good song.
Beat that?
It's Beat It, isn't it?
Well, I was thinking Beatles.
Oh. Both puns didn't work. Number three is No More Lonely Nights from his 1980s film that's got some spy connections itself. He did a Beatles-esque film in the 1980s called Give My Regards to Broad Street. And the song for that film was No More Lonely Nights, which is actually quite a nice song if you like sort of his more weepier, wistful Paul McCartney numbers.
Okay.
He then at number four, I don't really like the song, but I went and just listened to it again. He did the soundtrack for Vanilla Sky, and he did the song for Vanilla Sky. Mm-hmm. So that's number four. And I just put this at number five.
Okay.
There are actually a couple of other ones you maybe could have thrown in at number five, but I thought I'd let Spies Like Us onto the sheet.
A damning critique.
It is.
Very interesting.
And thank you for coming in to me to the Beatles Corner. It's been a pleasure having you here. Let's get back to the review.
And my other note is another pop culture crossover here, where you had the 2009 Family Guy episode, Spies Reminiscent of Us, reteamed Aykroyd and Chase as a fictionalized version of themselves who were made real spies by Reagan after he saw this film. And apparently they recreated numerous scenes from this 85 film.
I actually went and watched it in preparation for this. They do painstakingly, I say painstakingly, it's animation. It's probably quite quickly done. Recreate several of the shots from this film, including the sort of Pepsi lift and the command center you see in the film. The thing that holds this all back is, unfortunately, this was done in 2009, and I think people's investment levels were a lot lower than they were in this mm-hmm. film. So if you've ever seen Chevy Chase's voiceover work for season 5 of Community, or you've ever seen Dan Aykroyd in the new Ghostbusters film, you get a feeling as to how invested they are.
Ouch. Ouch. Okay, that's fair. And of course, Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy, notorious for kind of being a blender of pop culture, especially like 1980s stuff. So it makes sense mm-hmm. to me that at a certain point, Spies Like Us would have popped up on his radar.
When's he getting the Ishtar reunion?
It's probably already happened. Oh, reunion? Never going to happen. But I'll bet she's had Ishtar references on Family Guy.
Oh, sure. Yeah, for sure.
I don't think Warren Beatty is doing it. Or Dustin Hoffman.
Really?
Beatty in particular. Beatty does not work much at all.
Okay. Well, Cam, it's here. Let's step into the Womp base and talk about Spies Like Us. We have had a very mixed track record when it comes to spy comedies on this show. So actually leaning more towards not liking them very much. So I'm curious to know where this discussion goes. I'm going to throw it to you first. What did you think of Spies Like Us?
So I watched this to ring in the new year on New Year's Eve. This was the movie that was playing at midnight when people started banging pots and pans outside my window.
Which is coincidental because that's the Paul McCartney song.
That's true, yes. So this will be a historical marker for me. I will always remember where I was when, you know, we hit 2024. For me, this movie has a shaggy sort of enjoyable 80s comedy energy mm-hmm. that I think if I was around at the time, I could understand why it would be viewed as lesser than a lot of the other films out there. For example, Fletch from the same year is a better film than this movie is.
Sure, yeah. I'd agree.
Or Ghostbusters, obviously. But there's something about that kind of vibe that I can enjoy. And I think that vibe is very active in the first half of this movie.
The training sequences and stuff.
Yes, the training sequences. A lot of the kind of world building and discovery of who these characters were and just watching the two of them be put together. That stuff I actually found quite fun. And it's breezy. It feels like a movie. I've often said this, and you've cited me as saying this as well, which is the clothesline for gags in comedies.
Yeah.
And this is that movie to a T. Like, it feels almost like underwritten in some ways, where it's just like, okay, we're going to come up with something. And you can see how people who are involved in sketch comedy worked on this movie, whether it's, you know, Aykroyd and Thomas or some of the other people associated with the film, because it just feels like it's people riffing a lot of the time, but it's also like, let's create little set pieces and just kind of connect them the way that a movie, say, like The Great Outdoors did as well. You could watch The Great Outdoors and rearrange scenes in any order and it wouldn't really matter. That's kind of what this feels like at certain points in the first half. I find this movie, though, once it turns into a movie that has to care about what it's doing in terms of plotting, just completely lost me. I found like the second half of this movie, I enjoyed seeing comedic actors I enjoy watching on screen, but it did not have much pace going, and I was getting a little bit impatient by the time we reached the end of the 100 minutes.
I can't agree more, unfortunately. It's really interesting. You can almost time the energy dissipating from this film when the snow hits.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true.
As soon as the plot has to move forward, everything stops. Even the comedy stops. And this is a comedy. and there are no jokes at times. It's crazy. But let me bring it back for a second, because something in this film works for me. It might be that 80s hangout vibe that you said, but there is another side to this. There is a darker side to this film that I really dug. There is this sort of quite sharp political satire going on here, which is a lot of it's actually happening more at home with the sort of CIA inner workings and just how stupid they are.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of like Burn After Reading at times. Although I'd say it does that does the satire a lot better than this does. But it feels like, and also like Doctor Strangelove, there's elements of that in this film. Like there's no fighting in the war room type sort of nonsense. I really appreciated that. And when it did sort of brush past those things. But this film, as you said, it is a clothesline for gags. And the point of view characters are your two bumbling spies, who I wonder, are we based off of? Maybe. We'll get back to that.
We're wearing those outfits.
Which ones? The snow outfits?
Yeah, the snow outfits.
That makes sense. I went for a fancy dress party on New Year's Eve last night, you see.
That I found to be a case with the back half of the movie was like, the comedy just became them wearing outfits. I made a note where it's just like, funny outfit comedy. That's basically what we're doing that back half.
And like visual sight gags of people in underwear and stuff. Like this is what we're dealing with here. Yeah.
Okay. It is. I wasn't going to bring this up now, but you, Bruce, brought it up of the woman in her lingerie. They have a real thing about white lingerie in this movie. But did you watch the Siskel and Ebert review of this movie?
I didn't.
It's amazing. It's Gene Siskel enjoyed the movie. He said he watched it on vacation in Hawaii.
I thought you were about to say it's Gene Siskel in white underwear.
No, he says he had a great time. He was on vacation and enjoyed watching the movie. And then Ebert comes on, and Ebert's entire critique, all he has to say about the movie at all, did you see that woman in the white lingerie in the snow? Like, oh my God, I was stupefied. And that is like his entire review of the movie. And Siskel's like, well, yeah, you enjoyed that, huh? He's like, I really did. I really, really did.
That guy's gone down a few marks in my book if that's all he's saying about this.
Well, it's so funny because like, and kind of weird, but like Ebert was always very vocal about the people he found very attractive in movies and would comment on it a lot. Mm-hmm. He always had a good sense as to who Ebert, who was catching his eye on the big screen. But oh my God, Vanessa Angel, who of course would be in Kingpin some years later after this movie. Roger Ebert was a very early fan, big time.
I almost want to cut in a clip of that just so you can all hear it.
I could do that.
All right, let's do it, folks. Here is a clip of just how weird it gets for Siskel and Ebert when they're talking about Spies Like Us.
I want you to give me permission here to be kind of human for a second, if that's be a novelty.
Thank you. You took the words out of my
mouth. What did you think about Vanessa Angel?
This is the well-developed woman at the
end. She is the Russian, one of the Russians at the end of the movie. Okay. That face, that figure, I'm telling you, I don't know who she is, but sometimes this is one of the reasons we go to the movies, not just to appreciate cinematic art, but occasionally to feel great cinematic lust. Yeah. She's a very attractive woman.
And she occurs at the end of the movie. So, Roger, think about it. You admit that the beginning is great. You're lusting after this woman at the end. Give it a thumbs up.
It's the middle.
Give it a
it's
thumbs
the middle
up.
That doesn't make it. So much for this week.
Well, was it worth it, folks? You let us know.
It did not make Ebert's top 10, unfortunately. I would have loved that if that was, he'd put it in his top 10 and had just that, you know, very similar quote from himself about it.
Nice undies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ebert. Roger Ebert. So yeah, I think this film had elements that I was quite interested in. I think it had some intellectual things to say about the secret services and the intelligence services worldwide and what their ineptitudes are, especially around the 1980s. You got to remember, this is the Berlin Wall's still up. This is, the Cold War is in its sort of dying throes at this point. Stuff is still going on, and we're beginning to understand just how inept our countries are at this point. This is where it's all sort of distrust in the system is coming from. I understand what they're going for there. But as Cam said, as soon as we get to the later half of the film, the comedy runs out, and you're just dealing with this like megalomaniacal plot that Doctor Strangelove does a lot better. And I'm just sat here pointing out films that did this better. We mentioned Ishtar earlier. Now, that film isn't better in any regards.
Yeah.
I feel like this is actually a better version of Ishtar in many ways.
In some ways, it's so weird. Like, I don't think either of them are successful entirely.
No.
But they both have interesting elements to them. Like, I could say some nice things about what Ishtar does that this movie doesn't, and vice versa.
And they both have actors pretending to do accents.
That is also true. I think Ishtar does it worse.
Yeah, I don't think Dustin Hoffman gets away with it as much as necessarily Chevy Chase does in this one.
No, because Chevy Chase is trying to at least speak the language versus Dustin Hoffman just ridiculing it.
But this is maybe gets to the bigger point, and maybe one of the reasons I didn't like Ishtar. Actually, it was one of the reasons I didn't like Ishtar. I just didn't find it as funny as I think I probably should have.
Yeah.
I just wasn't laughing. I was laughing at bits. I mean, there are some all-time classic jokes in this film.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned the doctor's thing at the top. That doctor's joke is so influential that doctors actually use it with each other. That's not just some sort of me making up nonsense. It is used in hospitals. Of people of a certain age will do that doctor joke in like doctor's offices. It's crazy. It has that sort of pop cultural penetration in that one element of the film. But I think if you ask people to recall Spies Like Us, apart from maybe the doctor joke and the training sequence, and I mean, I've got some other bits I like the examination at the beginning, which feels like Will Smith was cribbing on that for Men in Black. What has this film got?
Well, it's interesting because it's two of the biggest comedy stars of their era playing off each other. So I think there is a certain amount of appeal there.
Sure.
In the way that Ishtar has appeal because people enjoy it for Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty goofing off together.
Mm-hmm.
So it has that kind of vibe energy, which I can understand why this movie would have been a staple of, say, afternoon TV for so many. Like, this is what you could have totally thrown on after school or whatever. And it's just like a hangout vibe. But I think, you know, it's like you said, when it comes to, and I said as well, like when it comes to the plot aspects,
yeah,
you kind of check out. But if you were just watching this on TV, you could check out. You could be like, oh, you know what? Like, I watched the funny parts. I really enjoyed those. And that's what I talk about when I'm with my friends or whatever. Hey, remember that part where, you know, yada, yada, yada happened?
Yeah, there's a lot of films I could probably think of that I like moments. Hell, I even like the Ipcress file in moments. As a larger piece of work, it annoys me, and it doesn't quite work for me.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not me saying this film is unsuccessful.
Sure.
Or bad. I'm just surprised that with the pedigree involved, that I didn't click with it more. Because I'd love Chevy Chase in certain situations. I love Dan Aykroyd in most situations. Not recently, but, you know, what he's done in the past. And, you know, some other people behind the scenes. And Lord knows, I'm going to talk about cameos in a minute. And there are some great cameos in this film that should be popping laughs out of me. I mean, Terry Gilliam from Monty Python, which is my favorite comedy troupe of all time, is in this film for no reason whatsoever. I mean, he was directing like Brazil the year after this or something like that, or the year before. Like, this is... Why is Terry Gilliam here? It's like Ken Russell in The Russia House. Like, it doesn't make any sense, but it's funny.
This has the most director cameos, I think, that have ever happened in a single movie.
There are
it's
a lot.
It's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you mentioned Burn After Reading. Joel Cohen is in the film with standing next to Sam Raimi as guards, you know, when they are entering that, like, abandoned movie theater. And there's tons of them. Michael Apted, who directed World Is Not Enough, shows up at one point, and he's standing with Larry Cohen, who was a very popular 70s horror director.
Mm-hmm.
You have Martin Brest, who did Scent of a Woman, showing up at one point. It is just absolutely filled with directors, and plus people like Ray Harryhausen and Derek Meddings show up as also doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always fascinated when you have like cameos like this, because who are they for? The general audience has no idea who these people are.
Well, there was one cameo that was definitely for us.
Which one?
That's Bob Hope.
Oh, well, the Bob Hope one would kill an audience because Bob Hope was an incredibly popular figure in comedy in America. So, like, that would have been massive to have Bob Hope show up. It feels like a little bit of a, well, it's an acknowledgement, right? Because he's in all those road films, and to have him here is important, I'm sure, to what they want to sell this movie as. But, like, the director cameos throughout this movie, like, those are not getting even the slightest quickening of a pulse for the majority of moviegoers.
No, it's like an in-joke for other filmmakers, which is also kind of wonderful in its own way that they're doing it, because it wouldn't fly now.
No, like, can you imagine if, you know, I don't know, like, someone who is making a mainstream comedy now was like, I want to have a dozen directors pop up in this movie?
No, like, someone poops out Central Intelligence 2 and they're like, hey, Sam Mendes is here.
Yeah. I mean,
why?
The studio would be like, well, get me a Tarantino or a Christopher Nolan and I'm okay with this, or a Spielberg. But if you're throwing in, like, you know, all these other assorted directors that people aren't familiar with by what they look like, then get out of here.
Yeah, it just, it wouldn't fly. But let's talk about the things that we did like, because I do like the cameos and I want to talk about that a little bit more. But much as some of the comedy didn't work for me, you cannot deny that this is Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase firing on all cylinders. They are trying their best to give you the material.
And they are so locked into their comic personas. Mm-hmm. Like, this feels like machine tool to perfection comic personas that are showing up, because you have Chevy Chase as kind of the smug ladies' man type who's just a total bumbler.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, which isn't necessarily what he did in the National Lampoon's Vacation movies, where he was more clueless dad mode.
No.
But, you know, movies like Fletch really honed in on this type of persona for him. And mm-hmm. he's like really fun to watch just be like a total goofball here. And Aykroyd, king of the techno babble. And he was very good as people just spouting out kind of exposition in kind of like very capable, competent ways. You know, he does that a lot in Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm watching a scene like the two of them writing the exam, which is being overseen by Frank Oz, of course, who's a director himself and also the voice of Miss Piggy and Yoda. Like, that's fun to see. But like, the watching the two of them play off each other is great. Chevy Chase is just shameless cheating. It's almost like you have a case where I don't know that the gag is that funny. Chevy Chase is like inept and cheating on a test. But the way they take it, and they go to such an extreme where he's like rolling on the ground, like grabbing people's tests and writing himself like his own exam, that made it funny. It was the fact that Chevy Chase was so gopher broke in that scene.
I couldn't agree more. And like, another great moment, and it's all to do with Chevy Chase's delivery, is when he is captured and they're threatening to cut his fingers off by the Russians, I believe, are trying to threaten him to do so. And they said, we're going to chop your finger off. And he goes, yours or mine?
Yeah.
Deadpan delivery. And I genuinely like guffawed when I heard it. I wish there were more moments like that in the film, but I just cannot fault either of them for turning up and, like you said, knowing the assignment and really delivering us some comedy when they're the people that are the center of attention instead of necessarily the plot.
When Chevy Chase did that bit where he was talking in the microphone and started cutting out his voice,
mm-hmm.
I then had to question who originated that joke, because I always like associated it, just being my age, with Mike Myers doing it in Wayne's World.
Sure.
When he's up to the you know, the squawk box at the fast food restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Chevy Chase is doing it in 85 here. I'm wondering where that joke originated, but Chevy Chase does it incredibly well.
Well, it's interesting. One of the early notes I wrote down was a lot of Chevy Chase's material is stuff that he did in Community.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, Community happened like 20 years later. And so I'm sitting there watching him deliver the same jokes, and a part of me is like, I've seen this, you know? But then you have to sort of go, oh, hang on, this is him doing it 20 years earlier and a lot more physical. Like, he did the voiceover, like the phone, I think it was on a telephone in Community, that the phone is cutting out. Same premise. The fake heart attacks is something his character is known for, Pierce Hawthorne. And he just does it so well. I guess it's just part of his shtick.
Yeah. It's just so locked in at this point in time. And as we said, this was the Chevy Chase year where he's doing some of his best work. Like, Fletch is one of his all-time biggest movies.
But that makes sense, actually, something that you said earlier, that they were feeling their way through this and sort of writing it towards actual actors instead of having a character in mind. Because if they're writing these sequences in of him doing the heart attack, him doing the voice, him doing some other bits and bobs, flirting and sort of being quite heavy-handed with that is sort of a Fletch thing, I would say, too. It's, I think they're writing towards what's in Chevy Chase's sort of wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
They're not trying to make him stretch to something else. And I guess it's probably the same for Dan.
I would think so. Yeah, and even a scene like the Moonraker sequence where they're in the, you know, the gravity machine. The whole gag is the two of them walking out with like frozen faces at the end.
Yeah.
Like, imagine handing that to two other actors. It would just look like lame. There's something about these two who are able to create these bizarre looks on their faces that made me laugh. And I can think of a billion different examples of that sort of thing not working on me.
I've seen it. I mentioned I pooped on Central Intelligence just now. If you ask Kevin Hart and The Rock to do that scene, I don't think it lands.
I think like Kevin Hart might be able to do something, but I don't think Dwayne Johnson makes a moment like that funny.
I don't think he has the ability to make himself look like bad.
No.
Which is key to Chevy Chase.
Yeah, like both him and Aykroyd have like rubber faces too. Like they can really kind of distort their appearance the way they say like a Jim Carrey could as well. And so when they walk out, it just, the visual is hilarious. And the fact they hold it for so long makes it that much funnier. It's not like a quick, you know, blink and you'd miss it moment. It's like they walk down an entire hallway with those looks on their faces.
I hope they only had to do one or two takes of that because that's got to hurt.
And you know, if they did that scene now, they would CG their faces to look like weird.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, again, I don't know why I keep mentioning Central Intelligence, but they do that for The Rock in that film. They make him look a lot bigger as a youth and they mess with his face. That would all be CG.
Or even a movie, say, like from the Hot Shots Naked Gun era, they would have done like prosthetics to make the face look more extreme.
I mean, those films have like an exaggeration of reality.
Sure.
Than this does. But yeah, I think they picked the best actors they could for this film, and I love what they're doing. What about you, Karen? Something you liked?
Well, I want to just talk about some of like the visual gags in this as well, because let's talk about the comedy that really works. And this is the funniest moment in the entire movie for me, the moment that I actually rewound and watched three times because it was making me laugh so hard, which is not a thing that happens very often in comedies with me, is the vertical impact simulation sequence. I mean, this is, you know, props to John Landis, who shot this sequence perfectly. Mm-hmm. The setup of the two guys in this, like, rocket vehicle on top of, like, a platform. And we're like, And the way it just tilts forward, it just smashes into the ground. No other outcome was ever possible. But it reminded me, speaking of The Rock, of that scene in The Other Guys where him and Sam Jackson jump off the building. I don't know if you remember that scene where they're like doing the dramatic leap off of the building.
Is that when they plummet to their death?
Yes.
Basically?
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And the whole time you're watching them aim towards the ground and you're like, well, something's going to happen. What? And no, they're going to hit the ground. Yep. And this sequence had that same kind of thing where there was no other outcome that was possible, but somehow the entire buildup and then slow tipping off of the platform made it that much funnier.
Well, this is, and I sort of hinted at this earlier, something I find is actually in my dislike, so I'll try and circle around to it later, is I feel like this film is doing too many things at once. Mm. It wants to be this sort of satire of government and this sort of its ineptitude, but also it's all done in this vein of sort of surrealist comedy, especially that training sequence. Mm. And that is right back to Monty Python. I mentioned Terry Gilliam earlier. This is what Monty Python's Flying Circus was mostly all about, basically turning comedy on its head. And just having these hard cuts to things and just completely subverting your expectations for a scene. And that's exactly what you just described, what you thought was going to happen when that little plane plummeted to the ground. And it kills me. We stopped and laughed for 2 minutes when you mentioned that. Just the idea of that scene made us laugh.
Yeah. Like, that's the kind of moments that I look for in, like, a comedy that stick with me. And I kept wondering, like, why was there so much, like, visual imagination or just inspiration in the first half?
Yeah,
because when you get to the back half, these sequences just don't exist. Like, you can say, oh, look, you know, Aykroyd and Chase are dressed like space aliens, I guess, and being goofy.
But that didn't land.
No, it didn't land. And it doesn't have...
On the alien pun.
It doesn't, like, have moments that have that kind of inspiration that you see in, like, the training montages or even the sequence with them cheating on the test. That is, like, actors who are milking a moment for everything it's worth. And it may not be their A-level material, but it still clicks. And I just didn't find that that happened at a certain point in this film.
Well, even slightly further on, when they actually get to their target destination, they're sort of blundering around the desert and bumping into certain situations, and then they become doctors and have to perform a surgery.
Yeah.
Like, that's funny. It's a physical comedy moment that sticks with you. They're like trying to remove someone's appendix who just happens to die. It's great. But yeah, I don't know where the inspiration went.
Yeah, and just the fact that, like, you have Aykroyd ducking under the bed and looking through the book, like, that's funny. And then when they go to make the incision and the guy just, like, screams and then it just cuts to them, like, walking out whistling.
It's before that. It's when they're, like, putting the incisions in the wrong point and they keep looking at the other doctors who are, like, shaking their head. No, don't do it there. And then, yes, that's where you do it. It's great. Yeah. It's great stuff. I'm going to ask these questions hopefully to Dave later this week. Is sort of, you know, obviously I know he was only involved in an early stage of this, but was there ideas that maybe all just got shoved into the first part of the film? Was it like studio notes or something? Because one thing I want to bring up later is the ending of this film was changed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's very strange, and it happens a lot these days. It didn't happen as much back then.
Yeah. Another bit, though, that I thought was like really clever as well, talking about the stuff that works, was like there's the KGB guys that pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
That part, yeah, that didn't wow me in any way. But like, it's when they get out of the Jeep and they're going to walk away, you know, pretending to have to go to the bathroom and trading notes, and then they get there and the two guys are standing right in front of them. Like, that was a very funny visual gag, I thought, that was pulled off really well. Like, there's a level of, like, visual imagination that does spark every now and again in that first half.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good bit of camera trickery as well, because you see them in the background of the shot, and just as they come out of frame, it whips around and they're standing in front of them. Now, that's a one take they do that in. So it's a good bit of, like, trickery going on. So probably it wasn't one take. It was meant to look like one. But, yeah, there is some genuine ingenuity and some great comedy in this film. It just happens to be in the first 60 minutes.
Yeah, it's very strange. And I know, like, for example, the movie Stripes, the Bill Murray comedy,
mm-hmm.
That movie is another case where all of the setup is really fun. And then you get to the back end of the film, which features more of like the military aspect. It kind of just goes off a cliff.
Yeah.
And I feel that way with this one as well. But this one, I think, kicks in a little earlier than Stripes.
Well, this isn't the first time we've encountered this. And a few comedies we've looked at, that when the plot has to come back in, because inevitably there has to be some sort of denouement once it comes together, all the plots come together at the end and you get your ending, you don't care because you're here for the jokes, not for the plot. And, you know, one of the reasons why Burn After Reading is so successful for many people is the plot is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
It's stupid. It's about the people, and it is about the people the entire way through.
Yes. Yeah. And this movie, I think, like, unlike Burn After Reading, which is very focused on multiple personalities, you have a great sense as to who every individual is in Burn After Reading and why they're mm-hmm. each uniquely funny.
Yeah.
Versus here, you have your two leads who are funny. You know, mm-hmm. Chase and Aykroyd are great. Other than that, those two are kind of taking up the oxygen.
It's their film.
It is, yeah.
It is. Before I move us on to dislikes, I had a couple of other quick likes I would like to go through.
Okay.
We mentioned some of the moments. There's a lot of moments here. I liked the ineptitude angle, that sort of satire of government. I think that was great. I said I think this is Ishtar done better. The only other thing I mentioned, I sort of said it before, is I just loved Bob Hope.
Yeah.
And I never thought my favorite spy would make a return to this show. But here he is, Bob Hope, playing his way through on a golf tournament or something. It looks like that's what he's dressed for.
Yeah, I mean, he always swung a golf club when he was doing comedy. That was a big part of his act.
Right.
And then, of course, he was famous for his USO tours. So mm-hmm. I'm going to assume he was just on some sort of USO tour or visiting the doctors, I guess, in this case, perhaps.
Sure.
But it made it that much funnier because it felt like a very well-conceived cameo. It didn't feel like they were just dropping him in for no reason.
Yep.
It was a joke that landed, like that golf ball did. So I thought that was fun. I also just liked that this movie was not mean-spirited, and a lot of movies are. Burn After Reading is pretty mean-spirited.
Oh, yes.
It really is. But this one, it's interesting to me how it has a real humanitarian element to it, where like the Russians we meet towards the end of the movie that are hanging out with Aykroyd and Chase, they're all kind of on the same page together. It's more the governments that are causing problems, and in this case, this kind of military faction that wants to, you know, use their weapons to show that they can stop a Russian rocket mm-hmm. and what have you. They're the ones propelling the Cold War. The people just want to ultimately hang out and play Trivial Pursuit together.
Yeah, and this is where the sort of Dr. Strangelove idea came into my head, where it's just about this failure of governance causing these political machinations to continue for years upon years upon years. And that is quite funny. And they don't actually dig into it as much as I think they should have in this film, but maybe that would have taken away from some of the Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase ha-ha.
I think that is the problem. and that stuff is entirely driven by the Bruce Davison, William Prince characters, who they have that really kind of funny moment early on with
the cupboard. The
closet and the courier with the chain on his arm. But that feels like the only big comedic moment they really get.
They do have one right at the end.
Remind me?
When for some reason the army turns up to take down... For those of you who haven't actually watched it, the whole idea of this, and this is something you don't actually find out until the last 15 minutes, which is going to come back to us in a dislike, is that the government are trying to get a nuke to set off, fired from the Russians to start a Cold War, to start the war, basically World War III, as a means of using up their supply of nuclear missiles. They're trying to basically cause the war themselves. Mm-hmm. And the governing body that is behind sending our two spies is complicit in that, and they get caught when the army sort of take down this bunker at the end of the film. But they're like, they kidnapped us, we are actually here.
Right.
So they do have like a little like silliness at the end there too. But yeah, that is their sort of shining moment at the start. And I thought that's what the film was going to be, a lot of like sight gags, almost like Abrams Zucker-esque,
mm-hmm.
which you don't really get much more after that.
No. And yeah, I think that's kind of the problem, is that a lot of the message element is with those characters, but I don't mm-hmm. know that the audience is that eager to spend time with those guys.
No.
I think there's a sense of, get back to Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd, they're the people we want to hang out with.
Absolutely, and to be fair, that's why you're all here too.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Look alive, agents. We're here with important intel on how you can support the Spyhards podcast. See, we don't have Electra King bankrolling us, which is why the Spyhards Patreon is so crucial. But fear not, we have bonuses galore.
That's a bingo. Over on the Patreon, you can listen to our ever-expanding Agents in the Field library, where we review major movies from your favorite spy actors, plus our latest show, OSS, in which we dive into the world of cloak and dagger television, from Ian Fleming biopics to Le Carre miniseries and more. Now, Cam, tell the listeners about this week's top secret broadcast.
We're getting downright animated because we are going to tackle 2011's The Adventures of Tintin. Does Spielberg's adaptation of the beloved Hergé comic strips deliver? We'll investigate.
So strap on your Condor Man wings and soar into the future with us over at patreon.com/spyhards.
But before Big O zaps us with a red pulsating laser, let's get back to the spy jinx.
Okay, Cam, we're plummeting into the Womp Factory now. We got to look at dislikes.
Yeah.
Take us away.
Well, okay, I had to really start to think to myself, why wasn't the back half of this movie working for me? And I think there's a problem in that they want you to have a sense of urgency in this movie
sure.
towards what is going on with the rocket plot. And this is a movie built on like shambling, breezy, two guys cutting it up energy. And these two things do not work. And I think what might have, from what I was like watching at the end, where you have the military, they are like causing the launch of this rocket. They mm-hmm. are setting up their weapons, all this. There should be some sort of like sense of like, this is urgent. There's some sort of ticking clock here. There is something. And there isn't. And so you have the two characters who, first off, don't even know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So there's no sense of urgency to anything they're doing. There's never a sense of, like, something important's going on, and you got these two idiots messing it up. That's not happening. Mm-hmm. We don't even know what's going on with your main agents, which is Donna Dixon and the other doctor. Like, they are completely just off to the side. We don't really know what they're up to at all. And so you don't have a sense of, like, this kind of, like, fly in the ointment situation with Aykroyd and Chase. Mm-hmm. They're just there. And so it's really tough when the plot takes hold, because generally you want a plot to have momentum, and you're at a point where these two characters don't have momentum because they don't know where they're going. And a lot of the movie just feels like it's not setting up a situation where something important is going to happen unless these two idiots figure it out.
Yep.
I mean, they ultimately do figure out how to, although they go along, they're the ones that launched the rocket in the first place. So it's like there's not a sense of them having to solve a problem and everyone having to rely on two idiots. Like, at least that would generate tension. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Burn After Reading. That's a movie where it's just a bunch of idiots running in a circle. But that movie is like creating false tense situations that propel it. And I think that's a real problem here.
Well, you've You're referencing a film I've referenced before. I'll reference another one. Doctor Strangelove has a ticking clock almost throughout. There is a errant nuclear bomber, basically, that has to be taken down, or else it will start World War III. In the end, it isn't. And that's a good film. This doesn't have any of that going for it. You don't learn about what this military plot is until the, like, I think it's 30 minutes to go.
Yeah.
It's an hour and 40 minutes. Now, I gave kudos. We both gave kudos to Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase. And they are the only reason why I think this film is successful.
Yeah.
If you had two people that were lesser leading men leading this film, this would be entirely forgettable. But you've got two comedy giants, so at least you can watch them, because the plot has no interest in going anywhere. And frankly, it isn't all that interesting in the first place. It could have been with some changes. But yeah, there is no tension until maybe the last few, like 10, 15 minutes. And even then, you're not that invested, because almost like their story has ended. They actually give up and think they're all going to die.
Yeah.
So they go back to their tents to have sex one last time with their partners and you know, raise a toast and get obliterated in sort of the ensuing nuclear fallout, you know, mutually assured destruction, as they like to say. So why would I care? That's it. Our protagonists have stopped caring. So why should I?
Yeah, they never really cared that much in the first place. They're, you know, we're not that committed. And so you have, yeah, them going off to those tents. And then Aykroyd's like, oh, well, hold on. Oh, I think if we do this, that might stop it. So they get up, they bumble through this process, and, you know, nuclear war is averted. But it's not like it's a big dramatic moment. It's just like, oh, that'll fix the problem. Okay, cool. And again, it's like a shambling kind of energy. But I think for that to work, you've got to be delivering comedy in the second half the way you are in the first half, so that you don't care because you're laughing too much. And the problem is, I ain't laughing that much in the back half.
Because they stop making jokes.
Yeah, and it also starts to rely too much on the Donna Dixon character.
Or Chevy Chase one-liners a lot of the time.
Yeah, Chevy Chase one-liners. But yeah, the romantic subplot between Donna Dixon and Chevy Chase that just to me goes nowhere. It's not interesting and it's not funny.
And this is, I mentioned this earlier as well, just connecting it all together. And this is just from IMDb trivia. I have no other sort of reference. You may have more. That there was an alternate ending to this film where the bombs did go off and the world ends.
Hmm.
Which is very Doctor Strangelove, which I think is why the initial connection came to my head. And I think that would have been a far successful ending. Apparently it was changed because preview audiences thought it was too down, which it is. You know, everyone gets blown up. That's a pretty downbeat, I'd say.
It is, but I wonder if for that ending to work, the movie needs to be more cynical. And it
is. It is at times.
It is at times, but it's not a dark movie. It's pretty breezy, I think. Like, something like Strangelove can pull that off, or Burn After Reading could have pulled that off.
Mm-hmm.
But a movie like this, I don't know, where it's kind of just yuck it up and have good times with these two idiots.
Well, I don't think the ending that we got necessarily works with the whole, like, they're playing Trivial Pursuit for who has the most amount of nukes in the world.
It's not Comet Gold.
It really isn't. And also, I didn't know the answer to that question, which I can't remember the question either. But yeah, I think if they just shrugged their shoulders and the world had got blown up, I probably would have like gone, oh, well, that was at least taking a punt at telling it, having some sort of message to it. This just shrugs its way into the final 10 minutes. And apparently they had to come back and do some reshoots, which you can kind of see. It's all sort of stage-based. I don't know. I just think it's a shame. You had so much juice at the start of the film. The first hour is very juicy, if I'm using a juice analogy. And then it just stops. It runs out of juice. Ah.
Well, it really like limps to the finish line like Ishtar did, where Ishtar, you're just like having helicopter battles in like the end of the film, and you're like, who cares? I've just been watching these two idiots bumble around. I need to watch some of these Bob Hope, Bing Crosby road movies to see if that's the exact same situation, because in both this and Ishtar, they don't have a lot of momentum, and the plot elements are not interesting.
They just don't have an ending. I think a lot of it is they've written a bunch of skits.
Yeah.
And then they just loosely connect it. It's almost like how they make the Mission Impossible films, where it's, here's a bunch of stunts. How do we connect them?
But when I watch The Naked Gun or something, those are absurd movies. Like, they're so ridiculous. And yet, they find a way to make you interested in the plot. Like, when they have the reveal at the end as to what the bad guy's up to, it's completely ludicrous. But you're like, oh, that's a fun journey.
They just don't stop making jokes. I think that's the key there.
But isn't that what this movie is designed to do?
Well, it's designed to, but it doesn't. It does stop. It seems to just stop making jokes.
Yeah.
It baffles me. But I want to pivot onto something else that I didn't like. I haven't really mentioned.
Hmm.
And that is, and this would probably actually ruin the comedy at the start because I'm over-explaining things. But you have no indication as to why these two are friends.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, there's not even like a moment where they seem to really have any camaraderie. It's just like two guys who are
trying to save their bacon. They're just trying, because they both try and cheat at this exam we've mentioned, if you haven't seen it. And they get caught and they're offered a lifeline to be patsies on a mission. They're not told they're patsies, of course, they're decoys. But that's, and they both go, oh yeah, I don't want to get fired. They'll take the job, and they get sent on the mission. But like, from the second you see them in the exam, they're working together. And we're never really given an idea as to why.
I wonder how much of it is just shorthand with the audience at the time of like, well, those two are from Saturday Night Live together.
Sure.
So you just like jump through that hoop for them. But mm-hmm. when you watch the movie now, yeah, the movie doesn't really justify it at all as to why these two seem to get along. Like, what do they talk about?
Yeah, they wouldn't even be friends. I mean, from what you're told, Chevy Chase's character is basically a letter boy in whatever government agency this is. I think it's the CIA. And so, and you see him at his desk. He's very brash. He doesn't like talking to his co-workers. Whereas Dan Aykroyd is in, I wrote it down, sub-basement D25.
Yeah.
That's very far down in the building, which is another one of those sort of, I thought this was leaning into more of a Abrams Zucker style, how like convoluted it was for the guy to go and meet him down in the sub basement. I thought we were going for more that visual style of comedy, which we never really got later on. And he's like a nerd that keeps himself to himself. They have no reason to have ever interacted.
I could see it working better if it was like Aykroyd is a very like loner character in this, right? Like he's a guy who's mm-hmm. been in the basement forever. If he looked at Chevy Chase as this sort of like charismatic, womanizing type that he was sort of in awe of, even though Chevy Chase is a complete idiot.
Like he was Bond or something like that. Yeah, like he was the spy to be.
Or just like an element of that personality that he admired that he himself didn't have.
Sure.
That the movie could underline, even though we all know as an audience that Chevy Chase is a complete idiot mm-hmm. in the movie.
Yeah.
Like that would be funny unto itself, but the movie doesn't even acknowledge what they see in each other.
Much like Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty in Ishtar. Because they look up to each other for their musical abilities.
Yeah.
It was just a little thing. They meet at a random open mic night. They fall in love with each other's musical talents. They have none. And that's how the bond forms. It does involve two scenes in about 10 minutes of time. So you do have to invest that time in the film. But we also said in our review that the stuff in New York was the best bit of the film.
Well, they become like musical soulmates because they are the only one that recognize the genius of the other.
Yeah.
It's just a tiny little comedic conceit that they use really well in Ishtar, that here is completely absent. Completely. I mean, Ishtar comes out 2 years later. Do you think they were watching Spies Like Us and being like, how do we improve on that formula?
More desert.
Was Warren Beatty like sitting in a private screening room, like stroking his chin, and being like, I'm taking notes?
Spies like me?
No, he turns to Dustin Hoffman and underlines the us.
What, like winks at him. Like, ooh.
Yeah.
Ashtar.
It is crazy how similar these two movies are.
It is insane.
Like they really are really, really similar.
Obviously, before doing this show, it's not something I ever would have called out. But having done both films in less than a year, it is bizarre how connected they are. And like one's obviously held a lot higher than the other, although I don't think Spies Like Us is held particularly high, but I'm just more commenting on how low Ishtar is held.
Is it these days? There's been so many reappraisals of Ishtar.
That was my next point. But Ishtar is going through this sort of critical darling phase a lot of films seem to go through and they get found.
Yeah.
But is that ever going to happen to Spies Like Us?
I doubt it. It had its box office success. Its highlight period was when it came out.
Mm.
And then over the years playing on TV, maybe it does fade away with time. Whereas Ishtar is more later in life finding its audience. But it is crazy to me that like the two films are just so crazy similar. I mean, even they both stopped dead just to have like camel hijinks at a certain point. And I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this in Ishtar.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those jokes before. Mm.
Which one do you prefer? Which one would you rather rewatch?
Oh, I laughed at Spies Like Us.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I would watch Spies Like Us over Ishtar. Yeah.
I watched the first hour of Spies Like Us and then I turn it off.
Yeah, that's about where I sit as well.
Yeah. Which is, it bodes well for the upcoming question. Spoilers! It's not making it. but I think before we get to that very important question, final notes. I have a couple, but Cam, do you have anything?
I had a couple things. I like that the Russians have posters for famous Russian movies on the walls, like Dr. Zhivago and Reds. That got a laugh out of me. Another little moment that I feel like is going to be lost on a lot of people, especially now. There's a point early on in the movie where Chevy Chase is sitting at work watching a movie on his TV, and it's the musical She's Working Her Way Through College with Virginia Mayo, which co-starred Ronald Reagan. And I don't know that that joke plays particularly well in 2024.
Cam, I am so disappointed in you.
How so?
This is the second time this episode that you have just assumed the nation doesn't know something. You could find out that there are billions of fans of that film you've just told me the name of, and I've already forgotten. And you did assume that billions of people in this world had no idea that Dan Aykroyd writes films. I mean, what other assumptions do you have, Cam, huh?
Did you connect the dots on that one?
No.
I mean, I spotted Ronald Reagan, and look, a lot of people would of a certain age, but I think if you showed this movie to like a 20-year-old, that reference is right out the window.
No, I didn't get the reference. I knew there was, because I see a lot of these films get referenced in a lot of films that we watch. There are often callbacks to older films, and I know you usually pick up on them, so I was waiting for you to tell me what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, so that one, I actually had to pause because I didn't know the movie.
Okay.
But I recognized young Ronald Reagan in the film, and I was like, okay, this is some sort of like in-joke that probably would have played really well to a 1980s audience, but is somewhat, it's not quite as dusty as the painting in Dr. No.
No.
What is, though?
I've forgotten what painting that was already.
I can't remember now. Yeah.
But how did you pay your way through college, Cam?
I've never seen this movie. I guess I should watch it and see what it's all about.
Mm. Yeah, well, I've never seen Ronald Reagan act.
No, nor have I. I don't think. Maybe a small supporting role. He was a recognizable name that showed up in some high-profile projects, mm-hmm. but he was never like an A-lister.
Okay, fair enough.
The other just final note I had was that I thought it was a little amusing that Elmer Bernstein, who did the score for this movie, was working in some Lawrence of Arabia homages in some of the desert scenes.
Well, it's also interesting you mention the composer, because I think he did the score for Ghostbusters too.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And the song you hear a couple of times later on in this film, Soul Finger by the Bar K's.
Yeah.
It comes up a couple of times. Musically, it's very similar to Who You're Gonna Call.
It is, and this would have been his follow-up, I think, to Ghostbusters, or pretty close to.
Well, I mean, that song, the Bar K's song, is an actual song that existed way before that Ghostbusters theme tune existed, as far as I'm aware, anyway.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that he copied that song, but just it's interesting that musically he picked that song for this film, and rhythmically and musically it's very similar to Who You're Gonna Call, if that's what that song is called.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, he chose well because it fits his style.
Yeah, sure. It's more the music nerds out there that would have picked up on, connected those two dots. But yeah, the hook stayed with me, and I don't think the score stayed with me particularly. But I remember the Lawrence of Arabia bit you mentioned.
Yeah.
The only question I've got, Cam, and I mentioned it earlier, is watching this film specifically two times, I was very curious to sort of observe how much these two are like us.
Okay.
Spies like us.
Sure.
So I would like to hear, and I would like to hear what you all think as well, folks. Let us know. Contact at spyhards.com. Drop us an email or get in contact with us on social media. Who is who? I have a pick as to who is who, but I want to hear from you.
I feel like just by virtue of the fact I do the behind-the-scenes stuff that I'm the Aykroyd.
I think you are the Aykroyd of this, and I'm the Chevy Chase, which looking at their later careers, I wish I was more the Aykroyd.
I got that sweet, sweet Ghostbusters money. Frozen Empire coming soon.
Is he in that one too?
I think so, yeah.
Oh boy. And he's got his vodka. He loves talking about that.
Crystal Skull. That's right. Mm.
We are not sponsored by Dan Aykroyd or his vodka.
Yet.
Not yet. Give us a call, Dan. We're not doing much.
Who are you going to call? Spyhards.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I couldn't think of a better way of segueing us into the knock list. Kind of hinted at it already, but hey, I have to go through the motions here. Cam, what do you think?
No. And it bumps me out to say that because we have had weird luck with 80s spy comedies. There's got to be one, right, that's like an all-timer?
Well, there's a couple that we haven't looked at yet that I think have a good chance.
There are. But so far, when I look at like Gotcha, Spies Like Us, The Man with One Red Shoe, Jumpin' Jack Flash, I'm sure there's a couple others I'm forgetting. But like Ishtar, they have elements that I enjoy, but they really did not hit a home run with these spy comedies, a lot of the ones that came out in this decade. And that is the same case here. It just doesn't feel focused enough, and it loses its energy. And so I had fun with it. I had more fun with it than some of the other ones, but it does feel a little underwhelming. So, no.
I completely understand that. And I do have a follow-up question, but I'll just give my answer now and then sort of sign it off before I get to that question. It's clearly a no from me, too. I really quite like the first hour of this film, but I just don't like the rest. As a piece of work, I had some fun with it. I don't think I would revisit it in a hurry.
I'm in the same boat, yeah.
Yeah. So, there you go, folks. Two no's. And as such, Spies Like Us is not making the knock list. The dossier on the film is complete and filed as classified. But Cam, I said I had a question.
Mm.
You mentioned a bunch of spy comedies from the 1980s.
Yeah.
So far that we tackled. Which would you say is your favorite? I think it's Jumpin' Jack Flash. More stuff has stuck with me from that film than any of the other ones you mentioned. There might be more that I've not remembered, which is actually probably more damning than anything else. But like, I won't really forget Whoopi Goldberg being pulled into the paper shredder, or like her being pulled around in the phone booth, stuff like that. Funny gags. And she was very funny in that film. And then, of course, the reveal that Jonathan Pryce is the sexiest man alive will never leave my mind.
I feel like the one that has stuck with me the most is Gotcha, for whatever reason. I don't know that I hold it in particularly high regard in comparison to the others, but more moments from Gotcha have kind of lodged their way into my mind. Very little of Jumpin' Jack Flash has. I would put, I think, The Man with One Red Shoe at the bottom. I would say maybe the first hour of this is the best.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's fair. I think there's, in terms of the films we've just mentioned, and like, if you were to go through the pantheon of all comedies as a premise for a show, I think this would rank higher than anything else we've tackled if you were doing like a out of 10 ranking list.
I mean, if we're to consider Cloak and Dagger a comedy, I would put it higher.
I think that's meant to be more of a thriller. It actually has some tension and it is a bit like there is some peril.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it had like comedic stuff with Jack Flack and stuff that I think worked for me better.
Kids running into traffic is not meant to be funny, Cam.
It was the 80s.
It was the thing. It was the thing at the time. That's what you like to say, isn't it?
Yeah, it was the style at the time.
Thank you. Thank you. There you go, folks. That was our chat about 1985's Spies Like Us. But the journey does not stop there. Later this week, we are sitting down with Mr. Dave Thomas, one of the men behind the film, helped write it with lots of stories there. Plus, he directed his own spy film, which we will get into as well. So make sure you check out the Dave Thomas interview on Friday. But Cam, what have we got coming up next week?
We are going to look at the 1940 World War I B-movie thriller British Intelligence, starring Boris Karloff, none other than.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and also fully available on YouTube for you all to check out for free, and it's only 60 minutes.
Yeah, that's always a bonus. That's like spy ship territory.
It really is. And I you know, I won't spoil anything, but it's a 60 minutes that might be well spent.
Hmm.
So there you go, folks. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to join us, of course, later this week on Friday, as we sit down with comedian and writer Dave Thomas as he takes us through the making of Spies Like Us, plus his directorial work on John Travolta's spy film, The Expert, and some other bits and bobs. Talks about Arrested Development. Lots of fun there. And then next week, continue the spy jinx with 1940s World War One Boris Karloff film British Intelligence. If you like what you heard on the show, please consider supporting us on our Patreon. We are currently in the process of putting a website together through your donations. Every penny counts. Head to patreon.com/spyhards, or you can find a link in the show notes below. Over 50 bonus episodes to get access to monthly updates on the latest spy movie news from our debrief episodes. Check it out and make sure to follow us discreetly, as always, on social media at SpyHards. That's SpyHards on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But until next time, folks, see you next Wednesday.